Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities of political life. Has the balloon popped? Earlier this week, the Pentagon confirmed it had shot down yet another unidentified flying object in American airspace, and media commentators speculated that the four that have been shot down are Chinese spy balloons. Now, if this is the case, are we entering a new phase of Sino-Western grey zone aggression? The aggression, you might say, that dare not speak its name. To help me scrutinise the often inscrutable, I am delighted to welcome Sam Olson, co-founder and CEO of the Evenstar Institute. Sam has been studying and watching China for over 30 years. Hello, Sam.
Good morning, Lucy.
Really good to have you on my couch, as they say.
Thank you.
To explore a really fascinating country which often feels a bit like a blank screen in that very Freudian sense of we can project onto the country so much of our own fears and worries because we know so little about it. And then we get these little elements that pop up in the world and we think, oh gosh, maybe this is a sign of something happening. What do you think has been going on with these balloons, first of all?
Well, it is really difficult to understand what is happening at the highest echelons of the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party, because we really don't necessarily have all the tools that we would like in the West in terms of our connections and our ability to analyse the decision-making there. But we can make some very educated guesses based on sort of our analysis of what China's done in the past. And unfortunately, it looks like it's a bit of a cock-up. And there is this sense in the West that Xi Jinping and his cohort of senior leaders have everything under control. But with a population of 1.4-ish billion and a massive landmass and lots and lots of provincial level and other level leadership teams to deal with, people do things which the essential party doesn't really know about. And there's an old expression, which is the emperor is far away. And that applies today. And so what we think is probably most likely is that the people in charge of these weather balloons had their own program, which wasn't necessarily synced with what was happening in other parts of the senior leadership. And this has caused a bit of an outrage in the West. It is obviously not ideal for people who want to see American ties with China improve, because they've been noticeably bad in recent years. So why would the Communist Party, and this is one line of thinking, why would the Communist Party risk warming up those ties when it is obviously China and America that are both suffering from this fallout, with such a clumsy stunt? And so the majority of people that we speak to think it is just a cock-up, and that there is actually a spy game being played out without proper oversight from different parts of the government.
But presumably, if it is such a cock-up, it can't really be acknowledged as such by President Xi and his cohort, because they want to perpetuate that myth that he is all-powerful and that he is in control of everything. So how will it be playing out actually at home there?
Oh, it's a really good point. The Communist Party never, ever likes to lose face. And so you're totally right there. They would never turn around and say, oh, it was a mistake our side. And so to further the point of being control and actually showing the Communist Party in the best possible light, the officials have now announced that the US has been putting their own spy balloons over China. I think they said 10, without any evidence whatsoever. I think this is all part of a calculated response from the cock-up, which is to say, well, we need to make sure that we look like the good guys and that we're just responding to American aggression, which is often the line they take. And so we do not want to feel that we've been put into a corner by the Americans for doing something wrong or cock-up. It's actually all part of a of a bigger organized plan, which it probably isn't.
And reading the tea leaves on that is really important, isn't it? Because you don't want to make a mistake that doesn't really exist. You don't want to respond to something that's aggressive that isn't really aggressive. And yet at the same time, to have things in a grey zone means that everybody's not quite sure. So they're caught on the hop and nobody can be really clear. Do you think that is that an ongoing feature of Western relationships with China, that it's nothing ever gets spoken about overtly, so that nothing can be, everything can be denied?
Yes, I think there's two parts to that, and the both of which come together to mean it's really difficult to have a very good relationship between the West and China, because at the heart of everything is a misunderstanding, and the broader misunderstanding comes from the fact that there's very little cultural overlap between the West and China. So when the Soviets and the West were having the proper Cold War, the old-fashioned Cold War, it was at least possible for Western diplomats to go to Russia and to share in a huge shared cultural hinterland, whether it was going to the Bolshoi Ballet to see Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, or whether it was talking about Tolstoy, or whether it was discussing Russian diplomats discussing about Dickens or about Shakespeare, and Shakespeare obviously through Pushkin is a big feature in Russia. But within the Chinese hierarchy, there was a lot of understanding about the West, because a lot of them have been to school and university in the West. But Western diplomats have such little understanding of China, unless they've made China their career, and there's very few of them that have done that. And so it makes it harder to understand from a cultural perspective what China actually wants. And therefore mistakes can arise. And then at a more specific level, there is a problem, because the Chinese power structure, whether that's in ships, whether it's in or the military, I should say rather, or whether it's in the Communist Party, etc., has no direct equivalent within the West. And so if we in the West, if you send a prime minister from country A to country B, and there's another prime minister there, they can sit down and they know that there is an equivalence of rank. And within the Chinese structure, and this is something that the Americans have long struggled with for very, very many decades, is that if they go to China, they don't necessarily know that the person they're talking to is of the same rank and actually can make the same decisions that they are authorized to, which means that negotiations by default are often fraught with uncertainty. And this is something that the diplomats we speak to, have spoken to for many years, will often comment on. And that creates, again, a barrier between trust and being able to get things done. And I think that if you've got those two things coming together, then it is hard for the West and China to really find areas of commonality in terms of policy, but also just in areas of commonality and the way to approach policies in the first place.
And also, presumably, the psychology of a relationship, whether that's between the US and China or the UK and China, is coloured by the fact that it's not just about the country, but it's about this all-pervasive party, the Communist Party, which is synonymous with the country, in a way that political parties in the West, that you don't get that same overlap.
Correct. And again, it's interesting that there's only about 90-ish million members of the Communist Party in China out of a population of 1.3, 1.4 billion. So it's a very small amount. And in fact, there are far more Christians in China now than there are members of the Communist Party, which has led some people to think that the Chinese Christian communities will be a power base moving forward. But obviously, that's a long way to come. But it is interesting that actually, percentage-wise, the Communist Party is small, but it's obviously a very powerful part of society, because in order to achieve anything, you really need to be a member. And that does have a separate power structure to the normal bureaucracy within China. And so, for example, on military ships, you have the ship's captain and the ship's crew, but you also have the Communist Party commissars. And there is an argument that a commissar actually can overrule the ship's captain, much as the way that they were able to do in the Soviet Union. And that causes, again, problems of uncertainty in dealing between the two blocks, because if you have ships, military ships who are in a, say, American ship and a Chinese ship in the South China Sea, and they're steaming towards each other, the Chinese ship's captain might say, "Well, we obviously, from a maritime point of view, we need to swerve now." But from a political commissar point of view, it'd be like, "Well, actually, we need to create a political storm here, and therefore, we're not going to swerve," leading to collisions, etc. And these are real scenarios that are being exercised and played out in Western navies because they're so threatening and so potentially real.
And I was interested in that statistic about there being more Christians than members of the Communist Party. Does that explain to some degree President Xi's obsession with his power base and sort of shoring that up over the last few years to perhaps compensate for the fact that there might be a declining popularity in the Communist Party? Or are we to, or am I conflating two things here and actually President Xi is just a megalomaniac?
I don't think he's a megalomaniac. I've spent a lot of time talking to people who sort of know him or reading about people that know him. For example, Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister, and that is not necessarily the impression we get. What we get is a man who is absolutely driven by patriotism slash nationalism to make China great again in a similar way to Trump, but perhaps with more power and a longer term concerted effort. And there's two things playing out within the Communist Party. First of all is and this is the most important thing that everyone has to understand when it comes to understanding about China, is first and foremost is that the Communist Party needs and desires to stay in power. Years ago, I was having lunch with a mid-tier Communist Party official in southern China, and he told me all about the Iraqi Revolution of 1958 and about how the king had been killed by his in his palace, his family being killed, etc., etc. It was a terrible story, and I was wondering why he was saying it to me. And then he turned to me and said, "And that is exactly what will happen to the Communist Party officials if we ever lose power." And if you go through Chinese history, which is amazing, and I've spent many, many decades looking at Chinese history because it is full of stories and of lessons learned, but one of the key lessons learned is that when Chinese dynasties, of which the Chinese Communist Party is, in all intents and purposes, a new dynasty, when they lose power, huge numbers of people die, especially those from the ruling dynasty. And it's not just them, but it's their families too. They lose all their property, their assets, and so therefore, the Chinese Communist Party knows that if they don't stay in power, they await a fate that has been the fate of the dynasties ruling before them, which is not something they want to countenance. And so when they look at their internal security apparatus, when they look at their foreign policy, when they look at their economic decisions, everything is around how does the Communist Party stay in power for as long as possible. And so that, I think, is an important thing for us to recognize about Xi. And the second thing about Xi, and this is perhaps slightly more onto your psychological or terms, is around the fact that people like Kevin Rudd and others say that he's absolutely desirous to be known as the most important communist leader since Mao, and in fact, to place himself on a par with Mao. Which means he has to do great things to the country for history to be very kind to him. And that means he has to have a great legacy, and that legacy will be taken in the form of the Chinese dream, which many of your listeners will know about. But just to be clear, it's about China becoming a or the great power by 2049. That is something actually which has been accelerated because Xi won't be around in 2049 because of his age. But the fact is that putting China back to where they think it should be, i.e., top dog on the world stage, is something the Communist Party actually want to do. And those two things together, staying in power and being top dog, both of which obviously combine in the psychology, not only the CCP, but in the psychology of the people too.
Well, that's extraordinary because that could be their desire. But then events, dear boy, events come along. And I'm thinking of obviously the pandemic, most notably, and the balloons as a secondary issue that gee, you can't control everything. You might have a vision and you might have a dream for your legacy, but actually, how you deal with the things on the ground or maybe things up in the air are going to be the key factors. So how has President Xi's position been affected, let's say, in the last 2 years for the pandemic and the last 2 weeks because of the balloons?
Well, yes, it's a great question. I'm not sure, actually, that either of them play a big part in what could happen to China. Both will be contributory factors, but there are other things which are more important. So if you're looking at the CCP staying in power, what are the things that could derail it? Well, economic collapse or disruption, population disruption, environmental disruption, all those things are possible foreshadowers of calamity. And all of them are big deal in China. Environmentally, for example, they're running out of water. 47% of northern China's water is unpotable because of pollution. And the rivers are drying up and they've got less rainfall and huge droughts affecting parts of the country now over the last few years. And so there's a real worry about water shortages, plus obviously the long-standing issues with pollution and air pollution. Then from a population point of view, they are going to lose approximately 100 million workers by the end of this decade because of population decline. They look to lose potentially a population about 500-700 million by the end of this century, leaving them maybe 700 million people. And considering that America might have about 500 million people by the end of this century, obviously that's going to be a big shift in things because America will still be a lot richer than China, but on a per person basis. And then internal security, one of the big issues that China's got is that they've got huge amounts of extra men. And this is because of the one child per family rule, which led to female infanticide on a massive scale. And there are, by the upper estimates now, if those upper estimates estimates of about 30-40 million extra men in China, if that's true, that means that there are more single men in China now than there are men total in America between the ages of 20 and 60.
Oh my goodness. Get on those dating apps.
Yeah. So, and it is extraordinary. And people, economic development specialists, when they look at China in the last few years, but starting just before COVID, and they're getting it back into the country now, so we'll get the latest research very soon. But just before COVID, we were seeing economic disruption leading to huge numbers of men being laid off the factories. And that means that they're going back to their home villages and they're getting a lot of anger and discontentment about their future because their Chinese dream is slipping away from them if they're unemployed. And the problem is that about half, just more than half of the population in China lives in the rural areas. But of those rural people, so 600-700 million people, only 11% have got a high school education. So most people there are functionally illiterate, the worst educated population in the middle income countries. And so how do you actually take those people and make them economically functioning in the society if you're trying to move a economy away from unskilled labor such as concrete factories and steel factories as the Chinese are? And the reason they want to do that is because they've built everything they can internally, which is they've built all the bridges, they've built the high-speed rail they need. They're building the high-speed rail equivalent now between sort of Market Harbour and Loughborough in Leicestershire. I mean, there's no reason for a lot of what they're doing. And so that means that their economy is struggling, it's suffering in lots of different areas. So if you bring the demographic problems and the economic problems and the environmental problems all together, then you can see that there are huge challenges for the Chinese Communist Party in keeping the great dream flying. And of course, that means that if you've got a lot of stress happening at the top, that means that they're more likely to do things which are perhaps take more calculated risks or be more aggressive abroad if they think that they can do things which will help them to perpetuate their rule. So we are entering a much more dangerous time simply because of the challenges that they face at home. And if they start reflecting in the international arena, then obviously that destabilizes international geopolitics, which again, in turn, destabilizes the American approach to them. And we enter a cycle of destabilization, which obviously can lead to very serious things happening.
And of course, we need to play our part in that, don't we? We need to really understand China on this matter. And I think what I notice closer to home is that we've got a real division emerging within the government. You've got Ian Duncan-Smith urging Rishi Sunak to take a much tougher line with China. I think he's very frightened that Rishi is weakening the position that he appeared to adopt during the sort of leadership race. And you've got many stories in newspapers over the last few days warning of, you know, Chinese linked cameras and drones that are being used by UK police forces and things like that. That there is that the psychology of it is we're trying to still create this picture that China is a bad country and it's snooping on us and it just wants to take over the world. And that kind of caricature can't be very helpful. So what do you think we here in the UK need to do to finesse our relationship with China so that it's a bit more realistic rather than a psychological bogeyman?
Well, I think that it is very important to note that China has a role to play in the world. It has a massively important role to play. So the biggest population, or almost with India now changing hands, but it is also the center of 30% of the world's manufacturing. It is able to do things in the on the logistics side, which are very difficult for other countries to do. For example, in high-end, you know, garments or electronics manufacture, etc. But that does pose a risk, because if we do have a breakup of Western Chinese relations, then our economies in the West will be significantly impacted if we get cut off from China. And there is, if we put sanctions on China for doing something like over Taiwan or whatever, then China has counter-sanction laws, which means that they will automatically sanction our companies, which basically means that our companies will have to leave China. Because the threat is, the punishment is appropriation of assets and imprisonment of staff. And so we call that the great split. And it is likely that if sanctions are put on, that a great split between the West and China will happen very quickly, both politically and economically. And that will lead to massive economic dislocation in the West, because we rely on China for so many things, raw materials, components, etc. But also remember, China relies on us for an awful lot of things. But the difference is that China's leaders put political stability and political dominance, i.e. of the CCP, ahead of the economy, because they know that in the longer term, the economy will right itself, but the political side won't right itself if the CCP have been kicked out. So I think that they have more political resilience than us in terms of potential economic warfare.
Do you think? They're just playing a longer game.
Yeah.
Whereas we're playing a game,
well, they have to, because
which is a different political cycle. We're always looking at the next general election.
Yes. Yes, it totally right. And I think we need to get longer term thinking in our heads. But at the same time, we should be also trying to work out ways to work together with China. And one of them is climate change. And I know perhaps people get a bit bored of this. We need to find a way to do something with Beijing over fighting, you know, carbon emissions or whatever. But it's true. And, you know, I would say to the Just Stop Oil protesters and the other climate change protesters in the UK, you know, you make zero impact on the world, absolutely zero impact on the world when it comes to your impact on what Britain can do with emissions. When you have China looming in the background. And just one example of that, last year or 2 years ago, President Xi made one announcement, which was to increase the amount of coal mined in China by hundreds of millions of tons. That one announcement was the equivalent of 300 years of total annual emissions by the UK. Okay, so if you really want to make a difference to worldwide climate change, then do not focus your efforts on the UK or France or even Europe, but focus your efforts on China. And you can either be antagonistic towards them, or we can all come together and say, okay, right, what is it we can do to work together to reduce emissions across the board and to invest in new technologies, etc. My fear, though, is that we are now in way past a stage of being able to trust, and it goes back to your earlier question, your first questions. Trust is in such short supply, and these balloons do not make it easier to change that. That I think that any plan that we have now on cooperating with new technologies for combating climate change, etc., would be considered to be something a bit would be not considered trustworthy by the other side, and therefore I don't necessarily think it would have legs.
What a beautiful note to end on. You're rather proving the Freudian point that sometimes a balloon is just a balloon, but actually it's also more than that. It's an emblem of the breakdown of trust in that really important relationship. Sam Olson, co-founder and CEO of the Even Start Institute, thank you very much indeed for being my guest on The Couch.
Thank you for having me.